This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us for the Ed Johnson Conversations, Part 4. In 1906, Ed Johnson, a young black man, was falsely accused and wrongfully convicted of a crime he did not commit here in Chattanooga, the assault and rape of Nevada Taylor, a young white woman. Johnson's case reached the United States Supreme Court, which issued a stay of execution, but a violent mob took the law into its own hands and lynched him on the Walnut Street Bridge. From his arrest, through his trial, to the final moments of his life, Ed Johnson said again and again, "I am an innocent man." We are bringing you a series of conversations with members of the Ed Johnson Project about his story from more than a century ago and the memorial in this century at the south end of the bridge where his life ended. This hour, we hear from LaFrederick Thurkill and Kevin Bate. For decades, LaFrederick has shared the Ed Johnson story across the Southeast and beyond, writing the play Dead Innocent and starting a scholarship to educate students about Ed Johnson. Kevin is an artist and muralist, best known for his murals of the Fallen Five, Faces on Frasier, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We begin with Ed Johnson at the Hamilton County Jail after a justice of the United States Supreme Court issued a stay of execution. LaFrederick, Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
The night of Monday, March 19th, 1906, the day before the telegram arrived with word from Justice John Marshall Harlan of a stay of execution in the case of Ed Johnson. Within 24 hours, we have a mob taking the law into its own hands.
In my play, Dead Innocent, the Ed Johnson story, there's a scene that captures the emotions that I imagine that Ed Johnson may have been feeling during that time. To know that a stay of execution had been ordered, and when his attorney came back to town to inform him of that, as he lay in the jail cell, he was not as excited as one would think he would have been, knowing that a stay of execution had been placed on his behalf, because he felt that he had already been convicted by the public and found guilty in their eyes. And so, although he was pleased to know that this stay of execution had been put in place for him, I don't think it did anything for him emotionally. And to know that, as a person who felt that they were innocent, and to know that he felt that this was wrong and that he had not committed this crime, but that because his name was suggested in the crowd and used by Will Hickson as a name to get the bounty from the sheriff, he was at peace knowing on the inside that he was innocent and not worried about what the crowd outside was thinking. And he already knew in his mind what was going to happen to him. And I think that he had found this place of peace within himself to understand that they would never see him as being innocent simply because the false information that had been spread about him. But I think that he, at that point in his journey, had reached a place of forgiveness. And I think that he was at peace. So I don't know if that stay of execution did anything to lift his spirits emotionally, because he already knew what was going to happen to him physically.
I also have to wonder if, as a black man living in that time, if he didn't think, man, the federal government has failed me before. I don't know why people expect me to put my faith in them now.
And also, from our previous conversation, one thing that we discussed was on that Sunday, he was baptized there in the jail.
Correct. And the members from his church came over to the jailhouse because, again, I think that Ed had reached a point in his own personal salvation to know that he was innocent, and he just wanted to make sure that his life was right with God prior to being judged by people. And so I think that it must have been a very moving time in the jailhouse to know that the jailers even allowed the church members to come in and conduct this church service, and allowing him to be baptized with water being poured over his head during this time. And for Ed Johnson, that was more important to him than I believe the stay of execution was. I believe that that was more important to him than any of the little bags of fruit that people were bringing to him and standing outside of the jail taking pictures of him. I think for him to know that his salvation was in order meant a lot.
And then we come to Monday night, March 19th, where the mob takes the law into its own hands, starting off with a dozen men entering the Hamilton County Jail, marching unopposed through the offices of Sheriff Joseph F. Shipp, through an unlocked iron door leading to the second floor, then up a flight of stairs. They found one deputy on duty, a 72-year-old man whom they easily overpowered.
The other jailers had been given the night off and were allowed to stay home. And I think that the sheriff knew what was going to happen. That theme there is remarkably similar to what we saw in our nation's capital on January the 6th, where they knew the crowd was coming. And some of them were co-conspirators in allowing it to happen or not preventing it from happening. I think for the jailer, I get a sense of the fact that he had some humility in trying to discourage the crowd from doing what they were doing, but being overwhelmed and overpowered. And I believe that even he was locked in a cell to keep him out of the way so that they could go and do whatever they had to do. And so I think more fault lies on those who allowed that and a plan to give the other jailers the night off, or the sheriff who decided to walk down Macaulay Avenue as opposed to getting a ride on his horse and buggy to get to the jailhouse sooner to prevent what was going on, even though he knew Ed Johnson was innocent.
Once they overpowered the deputy, they had to unlock the door to the corridor housing the jail cells. After the mob damaged the lock, the men used a sledgehammer and an axe to break down the door. And for 3 hours, they banged away as a crowd outside the jail grew to about 100 people. And then the sheriff arrived on the scene.
Correct. And I think the jailer that was in the cell next to him, who had befriended, I believe her name was Ellen, was asking him, aren't you afraid? And I think for Ed Johnson, he knew he'd already come to that peace. He already knew what was going to happen. And so I believe at that point, he was probably just laying there waiting on him to come and get him. I don't think he showed a lot of resistance and put up a big fight because, again, in his mind, it had passed the point of no return for him. He knew what they were going to do, and he knew that all the pieces were in place to allow it to happen. I think at that point, he had given up the fight and was just at peace with probably saying, hurry up, come on, let's get this over with so I don't have to deal with this anymore.
That's one of the things I admire about this man. I know me, and I would have been shouting every word I could think of at these guys. Man, I would have made the baby Jesus cry with the words coming out of my mouth. Nothing in anything that I've read or heard about this man was he ever anything more than calm and almost polite to these men, even on the bridge. I don't know what it takes to be able to do that, but I know I don't have it in me. So I admire that in him.
As I've continued to research, even beyond the book, Contempt of Court, and I think that even as Leroy, before he passed, continued his efforts to research the case, I know we talk about new information that he had found.
We've told you about Contempt of Court, the book about the Ed Johnson case, written by Mark Curran and Leroy Phillips, published in 1999.
For instance, knowing that Ed Johnson was a laborer, the church where my grandmother attended, Shiloh Baptist, on the cornerstone of the church, you see Ed Johnson's brother's name there, knowing that he was also a laborer. And their niece, Ruby Johnson, who lived in Chattanooga up until the 1940s, who was still around, to know that, yeah, his story extended beyond the lynching. And as people continued to talk about his story and learn more about his story, more facts were uncovered with the type of man and the character that he had and was.
And one thing that was uncovered very recently, and when I say very recently, I'm talking about just a few years ago, was a photo of Ed Johnson.
Yes. To think that all the years that even Mark and Leroy, because I know by the time I met Leroy, he had been researching the case for 30 years then. Reverend Paul McDaniel and all the went down to the court to have his name cleared from the court records in Hamilton County.
The Reverend Paul A. McDaniel, now retired, was one of our guests in our previous conversation.
All the information that they had, nobody had a picture. And So it was just really startling to see what did this guy look like. And, you know, surprisingly enough, I think that there are pictures around, because when everybody was going down to the jail, taking pictures of him, bringing their little treats down there and bags of fruit and all this kind of stuff, there are plenty of pictures of Ed Johnson and some white homes and some suitcases or chests that are tucked away with maybe a little information about that passed on to the other generations. But I do believe that there are way more pictures than the one we have.
And I bet there's some fairly gruesome ones out there as well.
Mm-hmm. I think some may be at the Chattanooga Times, because when they were there at the lynching, and the police department, of the police officer who cut off his finger at the bridge, you know, after the body was hanged. I think that there are plenty more pictures. There's a lot of guilt. Maybe they don't want to share that their family was there, or maybe have a picture of it. But I guarantee you there's more pictures than that floating around.
As for the newspaper itself at that time, what it would publish at the time, its policy was not to publish photos of African Americans, and that was common throughout the South.
Yes, unless it was an atrocity such as a lynching, because those were used as souvenirs, and those kinds of horrific pictures depicting blacks in situations like that were trophy pieces. And so it may not have been published in the paper, but I believe just like in the Duluth, Minnesota lynching down at the lamppost where you have Parker and the other two guys that are hanging there, that picture became a postcard and was sent out around the nation. And so I believe that, yeah, there's some pictures, and it may not have been published in the paper, but I guarantee you there's some around. There probably some of those that went out as postcards.
On the night of the lynching, the sheriff, Joseph F. Shipp, arrives at the scene, having been alerted by a newspaper reporter to what was unfolding at the jail. Men seized the sheriff, carried him upstairs, hoping that he could produce the needed key to the door that they were in the process of breaking down. And after the sheriff refused, he allowed himself to be shut in the bathroom.
Of course. Of course. I think he was complicit. And I think it was, you know, you tear up the lock, you damage the lock beyond repair, and you can't get the door open that you're trying to get open because you've damaged the lock. I thought that was kind of dumb. But I think that the sheriff knew that what was going on. And again, that was his part in allowing himself to be shut up in the jail cell.
Again, the parallels to the Sixth are uncanny. And I can't remember who said this, but those who see evil and do nothing to stop it may be more evil. In reading through some notes to get ready for this today, I paid a lot more attention to the people in power who did nothing to help Ed Johnson. Actually, many of them actively tried to do stuff to hinder his ability to get aid. He was falsely accused to everyone, most to everyone's belief. You know, he had alibis. They were there at the Last Chance Saloon where he was working that night. But those were discounted because other white men said differently. He was offered two white lawyers who convinced him not to ask about an appeal, because if he appealed, he would be hanged, he'd be lynched. When he got two good lawyers working for him, when they went to the judge and said, hey, we're going to move forward on this, said, you got to come back and see me tomorrow. And when they came back tomorrow, he said, oh, I'm sorry, you're a day late. That window is closed. Sheriff Shipp, who had the man locked in a cage, was responsible for him, decided he didn't want that responsibility, and just kind of walked, let himself be locked in a closet. At every turn, when somebody could have said, hey, wait a second, go back to the trial. Depending on who you speak to, either a juror lunged at him and said, I'll cut your throat out. Two stories where they just said, you know, a juror in the stand said, you know, you make me sick or whatever it was. No alternate juror, no mistrial. No, we're going to keep moving forward on this. Let's go ahead and just slam dunk this. It pains me to see that nobody except the lawyers and the Supreme Court justice stood up for this man. That's my biggest problem with all this, is how many people let this happen.
And I think looking at that is an early form of systemic racism. And I think that it's still prevalent today. Those kinds of systems still operate in similar forms, even today, in cases where you've got blacks being killed by police officers unjustly, yet being allowed to get off free without being charged with the immunity pieces that they have in place. And so, unfortunately, for many African Americans, we don't see much change in the system. The system that did Ed Johnson that way then, did Sandra Bland that way just here recently,
yep.
did Trayvon Martin that way. It did so many other countless Blacks who have had to endure that same system or systemic racism in that networking of letting some of the bad people go free when they knew that they were guilty.
And a lot of the inequity, looking at the crimes versus the punishment for white and Black, one of the ones, I don't know why, Eric Garner just really smacked me in the face. He was selling loose cigarettes and they choked him out for it. They killed him. This was, what, 4 or 5 years ago, for selling cigarettes. And yet a boy like Dylann Roof can walk into a church. It was at Charleston.
Yes.
And mow down the congregation. And they took that boy for a hamburger before they took him to jail. Look at this past summer, George Floyd, they said he passed a counterfeit 20. They choked him out in plain view of, they knew people were filming. They didn't care. And I think that indicates what these people think of these two different kinds of criminals. Yeah, this guy shot 9 people at church, but he looks hungry. Let's go get him a hamburger, sport. And then just the contempt they must hold for these people where, wait a second, he passed a counterfeit 20? Oh, take him down. Get your knee on that neck. It really, really just floors me that they can look at another human being and think that there are such disparate levels of care for those two human beings. Frustrating to me.
That night, that Monday night in 1906, March 19th, when the mob finally, after 3 hours, broke down the door to the jail cell corridor, the men seized Ed Johnson. They tied his hands behind his back. They carted him to the Walnut Street Bridge spanning the Tennessee River. And that's when the mob slipped a noose around his neck and demanded that he confess. Instead, he reasserted his innocence. He said, "I'm ready to die, but I never done it."
Right. And I think, again, for him, and even when he said, "God bless you all, I'm an innocent man," or "I am a innocent man," to know that he wasn't worried about himself at that point, but he was extending grace to them because of their ignorance, or he was extending grace and compassion to them, knowing that this is going to be blood on your hands. I'll be gone. I won't have to deal with this any longer, but you still have to live and you still have to deal with this. So God bless you for the nightmares that you're going to have, the guilt that you're going to endure, the conscience that's going to nag at you. Just like Nevada Taylor, who less than a year or so after the trial dies of some mysterious illness. I think it was guilt. I think it was guilt that drove her to her death. And I think that as I worked and did some research and continue to do this kind of stuff, when I had to do the TV show Who Do You Think You Are with Lionel Richie, and I'm teaching him about his history.
Yes, the singer Lionel Richie.
It's interesting that a letter from Sheriff Shipp shows up in the work, where Sheriff Shipp wrote a letter on behalf of Lionel Richie's great-grandfather to the colored man's pension association to help his great-grandfather get his pension for Blacks who served in the Civil War. And so you say, is this his conscience changing now? Is this his good deed to try to do something on the behalf of a Black man, knowing what he did in his role with Ed Johnson? So I believe that when Ed Johnson said, "God forgive you," or "God bless you all, I am a innocent man," it was him being more worried about their life after his death than they were about their lives after Ed Johnson's death.
In those final moments, I want to pan back to the crowd. Not only there at the bridge, but back at the jail those past few hours. What do we know about this crowd? What do we know about who was in that crowd, who might have been in that crowd tied to all this?
I have read that Nevada Taylor's brother was there. I found a quote, I don't know if this is true, not being there, where it said that the time for justice and punishment has come. I can see that being true. I also read that the judge, and his name escapes me right now, was in the crowd. He and another justice could see either the jail or the bridge from their, I guess it would be the jail, from the window of their court. They walked down and they were in the mob. And I just don't know how a man who's sworn an oath can do something like that. I don't know how, this is my guilt seeping out, I don't know how a crowd of people can sit out there and watch something like that as sport. I can't understand why people didn't just kind of snap to and think, my God, what am I doing here?
I must say, it's no different than what we saw again on January the 6th, when you got a president sitting in a room watching a mob attack the Capitol when his own vice president is sitting there. You got policemen and ex-military people out in the crowd. You got congressmen, current congresspeople out in the crowd helping to create this attack on the Capitol. So when you say, I can see how it's done. I can't believe that they don't have a conscience. But again, it's no different than what we're seeing today.
There are a lot of parallels.
The same kind of people were in this mob as was in Ed Johnson's mob. I mean, to think that they were coming there to hang Mike Pence, and yet they were going there to hang Ed Johnson. Just an angry mob, a frenzied, angry mob with no conscience. And I don't believe anybody in the crowd had one either.
And the pattern of this during Jim Crow segregation, we see this crowd again and again and again. The crowd there on the night of Monday, March 19th, 1906, that spirit was in crowd after crowd in that time before and in that time after, in the thousands of known
right
lynchings in this country.
Exactly. I mean, it's unbelievable. And yet when America is called out about these kinds of things, it then becomes or wants to attack the person who calls them out, like Reverend Wright. It wasn't anything bad about America that he was hating about America. It was just saying that America, at some point, you're going to have to pay for the things that you've done. And I think that that's true with anybody, a criminal. You expect there to be consequences. You expect them to get sentenced. You expect them to get tried and, you know, all this stuff. Well, I think that that's no different than America. And I think that this country has still a lot of blood on its hands.
You're listening to Scenic Roots, the Ed Johnson Conversations. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots, the Ed Johnson Conversations, Part 4. I'm Ray Bassett. Before we proceed, we should warn those of you listening. We now come to the final moments of Ed Johnson's life on the Walnut Street Bridge here in Chattanooga. In the next few minutes, we will be recounting what the historical record tells us about those moments when a violent mob took the law into its own hands and took his life on March 19th, 1906. That record is bloody. In this series of conversations, we only have time to scratch the surface of all that was done and all that was said, as horrific as all of it was. You may want to listen to the next few minutes, or you may not. That is your choice. What we will present from the historical record of more than a century ago, right here and right now, is why we are still talking about Ed Johnson today and the memorial in his name at that bridge. Once again, joining us for this conversation are LaFredrick Thurkill and Kevin Bate.
Ed Johnson's final moments, as painful as this is to read and as painful as this is to hear, this is why we are talking about this man and this case more than a century later. At the bridge, the first attempt to hoist Ed Johnson failed, sending his body tumbling to the ground. On the second attempt, the rope held. When Ed Johnson appeared to still have life after a few minutes, the mob riddled his body with bullets. One bullet sliced the rope, sending him plummeting to the ground again. When someone in that crowd noticed that he was still alive, a deputy sheriff stepped forward and shot Ed Johnson 5 times at point blank range.
I think one of the things you have to keep in mind there is he didn't just shoot 5 times. He emptied his revolver into him. Back in the day, single action revolvers had a habit of, if you hit the hammer, it could go forward and hit the, strike the primer on the back of the shell, and you could actually shoot yourself in the foot. So they did what they called the cowboy load, where you put the hammer down on an empty chamber in the revolver. So that man walked up, and I believe I've read, he walked up and just emptied the gun. It wasn't like a coup de grace. It wasn't a final shot in the head to put him down. He just walked up and emptied his gun into the man. The contempt he must have felt for him was just unbelievable to me. Unbelievable.
And not only that, again, like you said, to hoist his body up the first time and know that that failed, and to have the body fall to the pavement and considering all the pain that the body must have gone through that time, but then to hoist the body back up again to ensure that he is dead and his body is riddled with bullets even while it's hanging. And it was only because one of the bullets severed the cable that his body eventually fell back down again. And to know that just the sight of a twitch would cause somebody to go over and unload their revolver into him. Consider the amount of hatred that was there. Consider the amount of just malice that was there. To know that that wasn't enough to make sure that he was dead. And he was innocent. He was innocent. You know, I sometimes compare this particular scene on the bridge with the Passion of Christ, or the walk to Golgotha, to hang on the cross there. And to know that in all this, you still have enough love in your heart to say, God, forgive them. They're going to suffer for what they're doing to me. To take self out of the equation, to be more concerned with those that hate you than to even be concerned with yourself was remarkable for me. To know that this man, and I think like Kevin, I couldn't have done that. I probably would have been saying all kinds of things. But to know that he was able to do that, but then not even to do that, but then to pen a letter to him afterwards. But then even beyond that, to leave the body there for hours, just laying there as a spectacle so that people could walk past and see it. And to know that nobody cared enough for him to even get his body up. And it wasn't until G.W. Franklin came along and retrieved the body for the purposes of the funeral. And in my play, there's a scene at the end where this elderly black lady walks up on Ed Johnson's body that's laying there on the bridge. And she says to him, well, they finally did it. They finally did it. You know, in other words, they wasn't going to stop until they just tortured and killed this black man over a lie. And over, you know, I wonder how Will Hickson felt, who told the initial lie, after going down to Mr. Harvey's coal yard and asking questions about Ed Johnson and then finding out, okay, I'm going to use this name to get this bounty. I wonder, did he have any remorse at the bridge after that? I'm sure he was there. I'm sure he was there. I wonder how he felt knowing, and did he even have a conscience? Part of me wonders again, yeah, if they had a conscience, because you can see stuff happening today with people who are easily misled. And so you wonder, is there a heart in there? Is there a conscience in there? How did you make you feel after you did this? Was that enough? Was it enough that you riddled the body with bullets, you hoisted him up twice, but then afterwards, you have to unload your revolver into him, and then the police officer comes over and cuts his finger off, a tip of his finger for a souvenir. At what point was enough enough? That's the piece that's always startling to me. When you know you were wrong, yet you walk in it and still don't have enough conscience to admit that you were wrong. At what point do you repent? At what point do you ask for forgiveness? Ed Johnson granted you forgiveness, but did you even ask for it for yourself? He said, God forgive you, or God bless you. Did you even say, God forgive me afterwards? That's what I find so startling. And then there are those who even today won't even acknowledge the Ed Johnson story, or who continues to think that he got what he deserved, knowing all the information that they have available to prove that it wasn't so, yet you still say he got what he deserved. Where is your conscience? Where's your heart? How could you be so empty that you couldn't even ask for forgiveness for yourself?
I look at some of these crowds here in our modern time, and I see people shouting things about other people. And I think there's no way to teach someone empathy if they have those feelings. I don't know how to change those people when I see them shouting about immigrants or other religions or other skin colors. If you don't have that seed in you to start yourself thinking, why do I feel this way? What's driving me to feel this way? Because I believe that's a lot of what it is. It's common. You always say, you know, kids aren't born prejudiced or racist or misogynistic or xenophobic. They have to be taught that. They've got to pick it up somehow. I just wonder if some of these people, does it ever occur to them, wow, this is really getting out of hand. Why am I acting like this? Do they look for the things that are spurring them on and think, this is really against the teachings that I'm supposed to be picking up Sunday mornings when I'm sitting in that big fancy building? I guess in this case, on the bridge that day, it's a mob mentality, and you get lost in that. And I suppose that's a thing that happens. I would like to think, kind of to the Frederick's question, did they ever feel any guilt? I want to hope that a couple people in that crowd, and it probably wasn't that night, it may not have been that year, but some night in their most private moments when they're laying in bed, it suddenly hits them. Oh man, I'm a monster. What I did was monstrous. And I hope that did give them pause every once in a while. But I know there weren't enough people who thought that way, or else this wouldn't have happened.
What do we know about the journey of Ed Johnson's body from that bridge where he was lynched, hanging from a girder of that bridge, to where he is buried today?
Well, I know that, again, G.W. Franklin, who was an undertaker, who is the predecessor to John P. Funeral Home that still exists today, he was the undertaker who went and retrieved Ed Johnson's body and prepared it for burial. And, of course, they had his funeral at the little Apex building right there off Market Street behind Trinity Baptist Church, where over 2,000 people attended his funeral, and some had to gather outside because the building was just small and wasn't large enough for all the people. From there, G.W. Franklin and another gentleman owned the property that is currently known as Pleasant Gardens right now. So when G.W. Franklin's got his, I guess some of his businesses caught up with back taxes, he had to sell, and Levi Young purchased his half of the cemetery. And so Levi Young became the owner of the entire cemetery. And so I believe that relationship with G.W. Franklin and maybe Ed Johnson's father, Skinbone, and the local churches and citizens who raised money to cover the cost of Ed Johnson's burial are the reason why. And of course, during that time, Pleasant Garden Cemetery was one of the only African-American cemeteries where people were being buried. Beck Knob Cemetery had closed by then. So Pleasant Gardens was the cemetery where African-Americans were being buried. And notably, Ed Johnson is not buried in the pauper section of the Pleasant Garden Cemetery, but he was granted or given a headstone of marble that is on his grave site. And so I believe that the community came together to not only cover the cost of the funeral, but also to purchase the headstone that we see at the grave site now. And that's the journey of his body from the bridge to the cemetery.
How is it cared for today?
Volunteers continue to care for it. There's a gentleman up there in the neighborhood who has made it his personal journey to go over to the cemetery every day since his wife has passed and clean up the cemetery. So he not only helps to clean the Ed Johnson gravesite, but the whole cemetery. Of course, you know, you got tons of notable African Americans that are buried in that cemetery, such as two of the Scottsboro Boys, and you got a Buffalo soldier that's there. You got Dr. Thomas Hagler, who was instrumental in developing the automatic defibrillator. You got Emma Wheeler, who was one of Chattanooga's first millionaires, African Americans, with hair care products. And so you got, you know, it was kind of a prestigious cemetery. This is the place to be buried if you were somebody in Chattanooga. So I think to reserve a space for Ed Johnson, to make sure that he went into the section of the cemetery for people who were recognized and was not just thrown over to the paupers, was a final way that the African-American community made sure that his name wasn't forgotten.
We've said several times that the grace and dignity that Ed Johnson showed during this is beyond me. I'm not saying that he did this easily. It was obviously not easy to put yourself up like this, but I wish there was some way we could let him know what's going on now, that what his death means now and what it's brought about. You know what I'm trying to say? If you just let him know that, listen, this is bad right now, and these animals don't care about who you are, but 100 years from now, there are going to be people who are going to be celebrating you and what you went through and the court case and everything. And I don't know if that'd make it better for him or not. I don't know.
I thoroughly agree. When I started the cemetery cleanups back in 99, I believe it was, one of the things that I noticed about Ed Johnson's grave site was it still had a mound. And after all those years, you would have thought that the mound would have receded by then and that it would have just been flat or caved in like some of the other grave sites that were there. And it always stood out to me. It looked as though he was recently buried because it still had a somewhat of a mound over it. And I think that the more we do in terms of honoring his name and sharing his story, that mound will eventually lower and become flat. And when that happens, I think he'll be at peace. I think that he can finally rest knowing that they know now that I was an innocent man. And I believe that that gives us an opportunity to continue the work.
All right. LeFrederick, Kevin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
In our next conversation, Eric Atkins and Judge Curtis Collier continue the story of Ed Johnson beyond his life. Our thanks to LeFrederick Thurkill, Kevin Bate, and the members of the Ed Johnson Project. Visit the project at its website, edjohnsonproject.com, and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We also thank Tony R. Smith Sr., Willie Kitchens, and their fellow musicians for I Am an Innocent Man, the Ed Johnson song, which we share in full here.
Oh, a 1906 conviction yielded an unjust prediction. A black man's soul Ed Johnson Railroad by a white man's jurisdiction. Chattanooga, Tennessee changed history on the Walnut Street Bridge for what he allegedly did. Truth failed in his living, but prevailed from his misgiving. Yeah, God bless you all. I am an innocent man. I took the fall. I am an innocent man. An innocent man. Print by the press caused the town's unrest. Made front page news with a vengeance. Black on white. With a woman that ain't right, a crime that brought a death sentence. Family not allowed,
oh, no,
in this unfair trial. A courtroom filled with whiteness, taken from a jail and led to a hell. On a bridge filled with darkness. Truth fell in his living.
Oh, yes.
But prevailed from his misgiving.
Oh.
Yeah. God bless you all.
Bless you all.
I am an innocent man. The fall. I am an innocent man. Innocent man. The high court appeal did not seem quite real. Never thought that day would ever come.
Never thought it would come.
Stay of execution was the court's solution. His attorneys knew he had won.
He had won.
Asked to confess, he said, God bless. I am an innocent man.
I'm an innocent man.
Under the moon, a black man gone too soon, they hung an innocent man. In his living,
Lord, yes it did.
But prevail from his misgiving.
Misgiving, yeah.
God bless you all. I am an innocent man.
I know I'm an innocent man, yes I am.
I took the fall. I am an innocent man.
Take the pain for it all.
God bless you all.
Oh yeah.
I am an innocent man.
I'm an innocent man.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.